Hello and welcome to Revolution Under Siege. This is a podcast from the 1919 Review, and it's about the Russian Civil War. You're listening to episode 11, Warlords of Siberia, the first episode of season 2, and the first episode that I'm recording in my own voice, as opposed to leaving the task to a robotic text-to-speech program. This is also the first episode of a new series, as I said, to review briefly the events that we covered last time. In the year 1918, the Russian Civil War broke out full scale, with the White Guards rising up and taking over most of Russia in an attempt to crush the October Revolution, and the Red Army being forged in the heat of the struggle to defend the revolution. Listen on to find out about the diverse and fascinating warlords of Siberia who ruled that vast region in the year 1919. When Russia was still fighting in the Great War and desperate for new recruits to replace the millions dead and wounded, the Provisional Government sent two cavalry officers to the furthest eastern reaches of the Empire. Their mission was to recruit a regiment of Mongols and Buryats, horse nomads of the steppe. Captain Grigory Semyonov was a Cossack of Buryat origins himself. He was, quote, a thick-set character with mustaches shaped like a water buffalo's horns, end quote. Semyonov's companion was Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg. He was a Baltic German aristocrat from Estonia, but he was already an old Asia hand. He had traveled in Mongolia, he idolized the warriors of the steppe, and on this journey he wore a bright red Chinese jacket and blue trousers. The young Baron had the thousand-yard stare. He had served in a regiment which had suffered 200% casualties in the early part of the Great War. But he was happy during the war years, never happier, because he was a psychopath. At the start of 1918, the mission consisted of Semyonov, Ungern, and six other guys with their horses. Meanwhile, back west in the capital, the working class organized into Soviets and led by the Bolshevik Party had taken power. The government that had sent Semyonov east no longer existed. The war into which the Mongols and Buryats would have been thrown was, for Russia, over. But the sabers of Semyonov and Ungern did not rest. They joined the counter-revolution and became warlords of Siberia. To them, the provisional government had been bad enough, but the revolution was an atrocity. Their first uprising was at Verkhny Udinsk, just a week or two after the storming of the Winter Palace. They were backed by Transbaikal Cossacks, but they failed and fled to China. On New Year's Day 1918, they crossed back into Russia. Their force of eight soldiers got on a train and lit it up to bluff that they had bigger numbers. In this way, they disarmed a Red garrison of 1,500. Eight guys. Meanwhile, a Bolshevik sailor and commissar named Kudryashev was on his way to Vladivostok with government money. He and his companions held a New Year's party on the moving train, and Kudryashev got so drunk he forgot to change trains. The mistake proved fatal. Instead of travelling on to Vladivostok, he was on his way to China and Ungern. They were halted near the Chinese border, and Ungern led soldiers into the carriage full of celebrating Reds. One presumes that the party at this point died a death. Ungern fixed his cold, piercing eyes on Kudryashev and demanded, quote, Deputy Naval Commissar, that's you? Baron Ungern looked through his papers, then made a cutting gesture with his hand to his companions. As for these shits, he added, pointing to the others from Kudryashev's party, whip them and throw them out. End quote. Kudryashev was taken out and shot dead in the snow. By Ungern's later standards, this was mild treatment. During the 6 months following the revolution, Semyonov and Ungern twice rounded up sizable forces in Manchuria. Mongols, Buryats, and anti-communist refugees from the Russian Empire. They twice invaded Siberia and were twice driven back across the border into China by the resistance of the Red Guards. So the Soviet Republic lived happily ever after. Or not. The fortunes of Semyonov changed, thanks to the Allies. First, Semyonov received a load of money from Britain, France, and especially Japan, allowing him to hire Chinese mercenaries and to arm and equip his volunteers. Thus, he built a force he called the Special Manchurian Division. Second, Semyonov and his division were on the brink of annihilation when they were saved by the Czechoslovak Revolt of May 1918. Finally, when the Special Manchurian Division invaded Russia for the third time in July 1918, it was with massive Czech and Japanese assistance. Once again, the counter-revolution did not stand on its own two feet. It was the Czech general Gajda who took Irkutsk, the key city and the gateway to Siberia, next to Lake Baikal. So, a few months earlier, Semyonov had been alone, except for a handful of volunteers and an eccentric baron, on a mission from a government that he despised. By the end of August, he was dictator of the Trans-Baikal and a key wheel in the White Guard counter-revolution. Covering more than 600,000 square kilometers, the Trans-Baikal region is only a little smaller than Texas. It stretches from Irkutsk in the west, a town on the shores of the vast Lake Baikal, which I just mentioned, to the Pacific port of Vladivostok in the east. Now let's take a quick look and get a sense of what these regimes looked like on the ground level. Semyonov and his regime. In late 1918 and through 1919, Semyonov ruled from the town of Chita under the slogan "For Law and Order," while his officers enjoyed cocaine and the company of sex workers. The nightlife of the city was lively, and was made much livelier by red partisan assassins lurking in the alleyways for any unsuspecting drunk white officer. Semyonov wished to create an independent state called Darsky, and allegedly awarded himself the title of Grand Duke. But in the words of a Chinese newspaper, he was caliph for an hour and a toy of the Japanese. He was more or less subordinate to the Japanese state, which had 70,000 soldiers on his territory, along with detachments from Britain, France, the US, and other countries. All the same, he lived like a king. He had 30 mistresses, who lived on what was called the summer train, along with a massive store of champagne and an orchestra made up of Austrian prisoners of war. In June 1918, he was elected Ataman, warlord, of the Transbaikal Cossack host. Semyonov used to boast that he could not sleep easily at night unless he had killed someone that day, and the Russian Civil War gave him plenty of opportunity to sleep easy at night. It was not an idle boast. His victims numbered in the thousands. By his own account, he personally supervised the torture of 6,500 people. In this last detail, Semyonov was not an outlier, though in other respects he certainly was. According to one foreign observer, White Guard officers, quote, remarked almost daily that it was necessary for them to whip, punish, or kill someone every day in order that the people know who was protecting them from the Bolsheviks, end quote. So this thing about not sleeping easily unless you killed someone that day didn't make him a massive outlier among the whites. The Transbaikal was sparsely settled. Trains plied the vast empty lands between the towns and villages. Semyonov and his 14,000 men, by spring 1919, did not generally stray far for outside of Chita, where the warlord lived in a compound guarded by artillery. But armoured trains would gain supplies for Semyonov's armies, in the manner of Caribbean pirates, pulling up to a station and threatening to open fire with naval guns unless food was handed over.
You're off the edge of the map, mate. Here there be monsters.
In Siberia, where the towns were like islands in the vast distances, thousands lived on the rails. Palmer says there were, quote, hospital cars, headquarters, brothels, traveling theatres, dining cars appointed like opulent Moscow restaurants, libraries, motor workshops, churches, mobile electric generators, printing shops, offices, and torture chambers. End quote. The old pre-revolutionary cadre of railway workers somehow kept everything moving. Secretly, they aided the Red Partisans. Then there were the prison trains, cattle cars filled each with 50 Red prisoners of war, which would travel, quote, aimlessly from station to station with neither food nor water, end quote. Whoever was left alive in the cars after a few weeks would be shot. For example, the train arrived near Lake Baikal on August 4th, crammed with 2,200 captives from the Red Army. Taken during the spring offensive, listen on for further details. Quote, most of the prisoners appear to be sick with typhus and starving. Several dead were removed from the cars. It seems there are dead to be removed at every station, end quote. The eyewitness just quoted was a British soldier who was guarding the railway line, which the whites were using for this purpose. The railways were the primary target of the Red Partisans, though they also infiltrated mines and triggered strikes. The huge distances and deep forests provided refuge to all those who wanted to fight the Semyonov regime, and they lived in camps, some as big as small towns. The regime of Baron Ungern. Ungern, the noble from Estonia, was now a major general under the Semyonov regime. His Asian Cavalry Division, a force which was growing in size to rival Semyonov's, would be called upon to lash out in reprisals at the villages in the aftermath of partisan raids. A fort of red stone dominated the border town and railway station of Dauria, and this was Ungern's castle. The railway lines were the source of supply for his army and regime. He robbed those who passed through, especially Chinese merchants. For some reason, he hated the Chinese. The sandy hills near town were scattered with the skulls and bones of Red prisoners who were sent to Dauria, the gallows of Siberia. Ungern ran a very strange regime that revolved around his own personality. He was cruel to officers, gentle to horses, popular with rank-and-file soldiers. Evening prayer services were probably the most ecumenical to be found in any military base in the whole world. Orthodox, Lutheran, Buddhist, and other holidays were officially celebrated. When typhus came to Dauria, Ungern went into the hospital and killed those infected who were unlikely to recover. He hated paperwork. When Semyonov sent an inspector, Ungern had him whipped and conscripted. He liked throwing his paperwork into the furnace. Within the confines of his own blood-drenched and occult moral code, Ungern was apparently austere and incorruptible. He was virtually the only Semyonovite who did not embezzle. On the contrary, he donated his own pay to the men. He did not believe that the Communist International had been founded only in March 1919. He believed that it had been founded in ancient times, in Babylon, no less. He read mystical signs in playing cards. He admired Mongolians and believed that they practiced magic. Semyonov was surrounded by cocaine and champagne. Ungern smoked opium so that he could have mystical visions. These visions anticipated those of Hitler. In Ungern's words, it was necessary to, quote, exterminate Jews so that neither men nor women, nor even the seed of this people, remain, end quote. In most respects, Ungern was singular. But here, like with Semyonov, we have to point out that in some respects, he was quite typical of the mainstream of ideas in the White Camp. In the White Guards, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and the so-called Sunder document circulated widely, both documents positing a massive Jewish conspiracy behind the revolution. And in the white propaganda, Jew and communist were treated almost as synonyms. They were interchangeable terms. With his extreme reactionary views, the mix of weird and contradictory ideas that informed them, his violent nature, his hatred of women, apparently he is what would now be called a voluntary celibate. Ungern reminds me of one of those mass shooters from today's United States. Other comparisons also spring to mind. Ungern was a bit like a much darker version of Lawrence of Arabia. or like a slightly darker version of your man from Dune.
Why haven't we heard from you?
My lord, I suspect so much. I think they are the allies we seek. They are strong, fierce. They do not give their loyalty easily or quickly. As you know, the Imperium has never been able to take a census of the Fremen. Everyone thinks that there are but few wandering here and there in the desert. My lord, I suspect an incredible secret has been kept on this planet. That the Fremen exist in vast numbers. Vast. And it is they who control Arrakis.
A Japanese-sponsored conference discussed founding a Pan-Mongolian state. That is, it'd take over bits of territory from Russia and from China. It should be obvious that the White Russians were not keen on the idea. Now, you'd think Ungern would be enthusiastic about this idea, but he was not at all. It seems he only liked Mongolians when they were romantic nomads. He didn't like literate Mongolian intellectuals gathering to discuss modern concepts like nation-states. Meanwhile, there were tensions between Mongolian factions. The Karachen Mongols from Inner Mongolia, today a province of China, they grew angry with delays in pay. 2 days of fighting raged in Doria, Ungern's seat of power, when 1,500 Karachen killed their Russian officers and seized an armored train. This revolt ended with the defeat of the Karachen. The regime of Admiral Kolchak. Moving westward along the Trans-Siberian Railway, we leave the Atamans behind and approach Kolchak.
Meanwhile, in the little city of Omsk in central Siberia, A.V. Kolchak, an admiral in the Tsar's navy, had declared himself the supreme ruler of all Russia. An expert in naval affairs, he knew little of land warfare. He was a big and sick child, a pure idealist without personal ambition, but weak-willed, systemless, incapable of understanding the situation, said his colleague, Baron Budberg. Kolchak tried hard to be popular and democratic, but with very little success. Nevertheless, the anti-Bolshevik forces of the entire world pinned their hopes to the supreme ruler. The Cossacks acknowledged his supremacy. The native chiefs brought him bread, salt, and live geese in token of their friendship. The people of Omsk turned out generously to celebrate his ascension. The priests led them to church to pray for Kolchak's triumph against the Soviets.
In a brief and I hope interesting aside, Kolchak was not the only admiral who, in 1919, found himself ruling supreme over a paradoxically landlocked territory. Miklós Horthy in Hungary found himself in the same position in the same year. Landlocked admirals are, it appears, not just a symbol but a product of collapsing empires. Moving on. By the time of Kolchak's coup, Semyonov had been in power for months. Semyonov felt threatened by this development and enforced a ruthless blockade over Kolchak's territory. Remember that the Trans-Siberian Railway line goes from the main Pacific port of Vladivostok through the Transbaikal, Semyonov's little empire. So a blockade was like Semyonov putting his boot on the admiral's jugular vein. The Trans-Siberian Railway was the narrow blood vessel connecting Omsk to the Pacific Ocean and to the Allies. An eyewitness recalled Kolchak's fury. Quote, if Ataman Semyonov had fallen into his hands now, the admiral would not have hesitated to have him shot on the spot. After negotiations and a standoff, Semyonov not only lifted his boot, but agreed to place himself under Kolchak's leadership. Later, Kolchak would formally and openly acknowledge Semyonov as the next highest leader of the White Cause in Siberia. They were never happy allies. While Semyonov was a proud and open reactionary, Kolchak was not entirely that way by nature and was in a position where he had to play a more delicate game in any case. While Ungern was dragging Chinese merchants off trains and Semyonov was swigging champagne with his mistresses, Kolchak was trying to conquer Moscow. Kolchak's officers were the kind of men who would challenge one another to duels and slap their soldiers in the face and raise entire villages. But Kolchak himself had to present his regime as more modern and democratic in spirit. He needed Allied support, and he needed to build up a mass regular army recruited from among ordinary peasants. So he needed those peasants to buy into his regime. So everything east of Irkutsk was a bloody embarrassment and in many ways a liability to Kolchak. But let's not forget, in other ways, the supreme ruler in Omsk relied on the warlords beyond Lake Baikal more than he cared to admit. According to Palmer, it was the realm of Ataman Semyonov that many Red prisoners of war were sent to, never to return. Those of Kolchak's faction believed, or at least claimed to believe, that there was a system of prison camps east of Lake Baikal. But there was no such thing. There were death trains, death barges, death compounds, firing squads, sabers, even in one recorded incident, an ice mallet. All this played, quote, a critical, gruesome part in the white infrastructure, end quote. Though we should note that a greater number of Red prisoners were simply recruited as very unreliable white soldiers. At least one author has claimed that Ungern was not representative of the white cause. But pointing to the prison trains and the mass graves, Palmer argues that the two really did depend on each other. This contrast between what it was and what it pretended to be defined Kolchak's regime. There was very little in the way of actual services being delivered or concrete tasks being carried out. It was, to adapt a common phrase, too many Ottomans, not enough Cossacks. Its military had a lot of top brass with impressive titles, but many were young junior officers who had no idea how to command tens of thousands. And soon they would be called upon to do just that. The Spring Offensive. In early 1919, the forces of Admiral Kolchak, they went on the offensive, and for months they enjoyed extraordinary success. In late 1918, the Komuch regime on the Volga had collapsed under the pressure of the Red Army. The key battle, you will remember, took place at Kazan. In the winter of 1918-19, five Red armies advanced into the Ural Mountains. In January 1919, Lenin envisaged this Eastern Army group taking Omsk within a month. It was not to be, and that's putting it mildly. Perhaps Lenin should have taken the Perm catastrophe as a warning. I mistakenly wrote in a previous post that after Kolchak's coup, the Czechs played little further role in the war. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was the Czech officer Gajda, who I previously mentioned, attacking Irkutsk, who now attacked the northern extremity of the Red Front at the end of 1918, seizing the town of Perm and throwing the Red Third Army back nearly 300 kilometres. Five Red armies. But were they proper armies in reality, or just armies on paper? If Gajda could devastate Third Army so easily, Kolchak had reason to believe that the whole Red War effort was ready to crumble, and many white officers remembered the Red Guards that they had faced in 1918, amateur soldiers. They assumed that the whole Red regime was characterized by this amateurism. The Admiral was a sincere and devoted leader who made a point of visiting the front lines and dispensing gifts to the soldiers. He was tormented by the dilemmas and pressures of the situation, shouting at his ministers, throwing things around his office, gouging at his desk with a penknife. Pushing the furniture was easier than tackling festering problems such as the warlordism of Semyonov, the rank corruption that infested his regime, or the lack of connection between his government ministries and actual services being delivered on the ground. He needed soldiers. Here in Siberia, the land question was less pressing, so the peasants were not as hostile to the whites as they were in other parts of Russia. But the trained veterans of World War I who had returned to civilian life in Siberia were of no use to Kolchak. The war had made them cynical, and in the trenches they had been quote-unquote infected with Bolshevik propaganda. From Kolchak's point of view, the war veterans were rotten. It was necessary to conscript tens of thousands of younger men, but these men were inexperienced. It would take a long time to train them up. Kolchak did not have time. At the start of 1919, it looked like the Allies were ready to sign a peace treaty with the Soviets. More on that in a future post. To get support and aid, Kolchak needed to show that he stood a chance of crushing the revolution once and for all. So he needed to launch an offensive, and he needed to do so in the narrow window between bleakest winter and the Rasputitsa, the season when every gully would be a roaring torrent and every artillery piece would be axle deep in mud. But the white forces exploited this narrow window of time with brilliance. On March 4th, they set off through the frozen Ural passes on skis and sledges. On the middle part of their front, the whites set their sights on the town of Ufa. They faced not some rabble of Red Guards, but the 5th Red Army, tempered at the Battle of Kazan. Nonetheless, by March 14th, 10 days later, Ufa was in white hands. The young conscripts were still back at Omsk being trained up. This offensive was made by Kolchak's Siberian army of officers and volunteers, bolstered by the incorporated remains of the Komuch People's Army and of some Czech units. So this was a victory of modest numbers against greater numbers. By the end of April, Kolchak's army had taken a territory the size of Britain, populated by 5 million people. In May, a white officer stood on a height in the reconquered city of Ufa and looked west, over the Bulaia River. Quote, "Beyond the Bulaia spread to the horizon the limitless plain, the rich, fruitful steppe. There were the home places so close to us. There was the goal, the Volga. And only the wall of the Internationale, which had impudently invaded our motherland, divided us from all that was closest and dearest." End quote. There is a profound irony in a White Guard officer complaining about the International. At that moment, behind his back to the east, the railway was held by a counter-revolutionary International. Japan, the Czechs, the US, Britain, France, etc. Allied battalions garrisoned the key Siberian cities for Kolchak. The British at Omsk were training up some of the conscripts. If that white officer who looked out over the Bulaia River carried a rifle as he looked westward from Ufa, the bullets in that rifle were British bullets. General Knox at Omsk, Kolchak's best friend among the Allies, claimed that every round fired by the Siberian whites since December 1918 had been made in Britain, delivered by British ships at Vladivostok and transported into the interior by British troops. The flow of supplies had increased. The spring offensive had succeeded in terms of land conquered and as a signal to the Allies. Now the peace proposals were a thing of the past, and the Allies had committed themselves with renewed energy to the task of strangling the Russian Revolution. Between October 1918 and October 1919, 79 ships arrived at Vladivostok, carrying 97,000 tons of military supplies. This meant over 1 million rifles, nearly 10,000 machine guns, and 622 artillery guns. That is to say nothing of railway carriages, uniforms, greatcoats, boots, etc. Even though a sizable portion of this must have been absorbed by looting and black marketeering as it passed through the criminal empire of Semyonov, these were vast supplies for a white army numbering only around 100,000. But next to what the whites hoped for, and next to what the reds feared, the role of the Allies fell short. When the Soviet war commissar, Trotsky, heard of Winston Churchill boasting about the crusade of 14 nations against Bolshevism, he responded with mockery. The whites, he pointed out, had been hoping for something more like 14 Allied divisions. Let's not lose sight of the fact that Allied aid to Kolchak was absolutely massive. That's 10 rifles to each soldier. That's the entire military industrial output of Soviet Russia for 1919, equaled by the Allies, and that's just for Kolchak, to say nothing of the other armies. It's safe to say they bankrolled this whole operation. And remember, there was even Allied aid before 1919 as well. Semyonov was a pirate king of the railways. Ungern hated the modern world. Kolchak and his officers denounced the International, but none of these warlords of Siberia would have made it very far without the Allies. Regardless, the whites had struck a heavy blow on the Eastern Front. The Ural Mountains had been reconquered for counter-revolution, and the Allies were staking 1 million rifles on the victory of Admiral Kolchak. By this time, as we will see in the next few posts, the threats to the Soviet Republic on other fronts had multiplied and grown. Thanks for listening. This has been Revolution Under Siege, Episode 11, Warlords of Siberia. This is a podcast from the 1919 Review. Look us up at 1919review.wordpress.com. There you can find a text version of this post. And that's all from me. And look to say her a boo. Slán leith.